lighting the way with positive energy and love. HRNradio.com.
Hello, everyone. It's good to have you there listening. Matter of fact, I always remember dear old Helen Keller basically saying deafness is darker by far than blindness. So, yes, listen to us, but listen to yourself, too. If you want to know where you're going and what's going to happen in your life, listen to yourself. Listen to what you tell other people and keep a journal. Anyway, speaking of journals and events, my co-host, Lionel Ketchian, founder of the Happiness Club, which is something, don't ever start a happiness club, and people always expect you to be happy. I know I'm not normal, so forgive me. But Lionel, you have been through some surgery, and I have a question for you. Because
sure.
One of the things that just drives me out of my mind, I do a lot of walking, you know, as a dog owner, and just meeting people when I go places. And how you doing?
Right.
How's everything?
Right.
And you know, I don't think they really care. Why don't they say hello? You know what I mean?
Yep.
I wouldn't mind so much like, how are you today? Or have a nice day.
Right.
But what, so I'm going to ask you, you know, you're walking down the street, you had surgery, and somebody says to you, how you doing? What would you answer them?
Well, I'm doing better, and thank you for asking, is what I would say.
You're grateful for their answer.
I am. I'm grateful for their question too. I mean, it's better than somebody just walking past you and no salutation whatsoever, isn't it?
Well, I wouldn't mind hello.
Okay.
Have a nice day. Because I think that 98% of the people don't really want an answer.
Well, let me stop you there. Aren't you assuming that for others?
Yeah.
Now,
they're total strangers.
Yeah, but
you know, I've had a guy delivering the papers, you know, to all the houses.
Right.
How you doing? He yells from his car as he's driving around. Hey, stop! I'll tell you. You know. and so it's that kind of thing. You know, I'd rather he look out the window and say, "Have a nice day," than "How you doing?" and drive by.
Well, you know, here's what I think. I think the less rules you have, the happier you could possibly be, because I don't really care what anybody says. I'm going to love them all the same. I don't have any rules that they need to follow for me to feel good about running across them.
Yeah, that's true. But I think for most of us, you know, you've heard me say this, it's true. When people were saying to me, how are you doing? I'd say I've run out of my antidepressant, my doctor's away on vacation, and I can't refill my prescription.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I was in one market, and I heard one of the employees yell, you're a doctor, you can fill your own prescription.
Yeah.
He thought I was really serious. I said, oh, thank you, that's wonderful. I didn't think of that. But, you know, my wife Bobby had said to me, you're not paying attention, you think it's funny. They don't. And that's when I realized, incredible, how many people were offering me antidepressants they had in their lockers at work, in their pocketbooks while shopping. And I was, you know, laughing and not really paying attention to them.
Yeah. Well, you know, Bernie, you know, the point you're really making is when you ask somebody how they are and they say, you know, let's say they had an operation or they're getting over a flu or they've been sick or whatever the case might be. People have seemingly much more connection, compassion to speak with them. Now, that's just what you're saying now, is that, you know, I hate to put it this way, but when somebody is either a victim of something or has gone through something, there's an awful lot of sympathy for that person. You know, everybody seems to.
But, you know, again, I was talking about total strangers.
Okay.
You know, going by and saying, how you doing? You know, if it's my neighbor or a relative in the family, I know they care, and
right.
they want to hear how I'm doing. And I may add, because I don't know, how do you respond to the people who know you who say, how are you? Do you tell them the truth?
Yeah, but you know something? I'm really, the truth is for, it. Let's see, December 27th this year, on December 27th, the truth is, I've been really well since December 24th, 1990, I've been pretty damn happy all the time. And here's the thing. That's because I figured something out. I figured out that I don't need a reason to be happy. I can use mindfulness to realize, well, okay, where am I? When I look inside of myself, I don't need reasons to feel good. Yeah, I had an operation, and I'm a little tired, and I don't feel, you know, that I'm as alert as I would like to be, you know. But
right.
But somebody's doctor had mentioned it may take a month to get back to normal, but I'm doing really, really well.
You know, you were saying what you have to be grateful for.
Yeah.
As you were saying, is the techniques today, the surgery that can be done today.
Yeah.
Because I've often said there are a lot of doctors who are trained to treat the disease and not the people. But
right.
Still, the technology is a gift.
You know, absolutely.
That's one of my mourning things, is to be grateful for life and for the
absolutely.
Mystery of it and the magic of it.
Absolutely. Well, I gotta also share this with you. My surgeon, you know, I had a prostate removal, robotic prostate removal, and they put five holes in your stomach area. You know, one of them is bigger to get the prostate out and so forth. But anyway. You know, he had shared something with me, you know, when I was when he saw me at 7 o'clock in the morning, you know, after the operation. And to me, it was like really hearing your voice in him, because what he was saying to me would have been something that I know you've told your patients. So here's what he says to me. He says to me, "How you doing? How's the pain and everything else?" I said, "No, I'm doing fine, because I haven't had any painkillers other than Advil or something like that when I need it." And he said, "You know, a lot of my patients, you know, even though I've done this surgery on them, he says, you might feel as though you did too many push-ups, but, you know, so it's kind of sore, but not painful." You said those exact words. You said it may be sore, but it doesn't need to be painful. Mm. And when you differentiate that, you don't mistake pain something it's not, and you could deal with it better. But because he told me this idea that he had in his mind, he allowed me to not, out of fear, take painkillers so that I don't end up having right. pain, and you know, and that's where all the trouble starts.
I gotta tell you two stories I learned from. One, when I was still, you might say, a technician, it was a surgeon who cared about people, but still. One of our kids came up to me in the morning and said, "My stomach hurts." And I said, "You've got a hernia. You're not supposed to have a hernia. That's for other children." But I was the pediatric surgeon in New Haven, so I wasn't going to let somebody else operate on him who didn't have all the training I had.
Sure.
So I showed him the hospital, the people. You know, I thought, he'll know everything. He won't be frightened. And we bring him in and do the surgery a couple of weeks later, and I go to sit by him in the recovery room. He opens his eyes, he looks at me, and he said, "You forgot to tell me it was going to hurt." That broke my heart, but boy, did he teach me something. You know, I realized, here you are, the doctor. You're showing him the whole hospital, the operating room, all the people. Mm-hmm. You didn't tell him it was going to hurt.
Right.
And he taught me a lot with that, you know. But it's also how you present it to people, as I said. Because I've said to a lot of anesthesiologists, you know, when you're going to put the IV in, don't say this will be a bee sting. Say it'll be a mosquito bite. You know, what a difference, you know, how the anxiety the person has. And I think that's so important. Oh, I had another story in my head.
You'll remember it. You'll remember.
But I've had patients, because of their attitude towards surgery, attend lectures I gave the night they had major surgery. And they weren't supposed to be discharged from the hospital. And, you know, you look at the audience, and here's a woman sitting there. I thought, what the hell is she doing here? So I ran down and said to her, "What are you doing here?" She said, "The nurses said, I'm one of your crazy patients. So they put all the tubes under my dress and let me come to your lecture." And those are the things that impressed me. Nurses would say to me, "Your patients are a problem. They're refusing pain medication."
Right.
I said, "Ever occur to you they're not hurting?"
Right.
They looked at me like I'm nuts. But it was how the person saw the surgery. Now I remember the story I wanted to tell you.
Okay.
My mother-in-law also developed a hernia, helping her husband, who was quadriplegic, you know, lifting and moving him and doing things with him. so we arranged to fix our hernia. And when it was done, we did it under local with some sedation. I knew I had to do something to keep her from having pain and get her to recover, you know, quickly. And then I thought, oh, I know what it is. So out loud, so everybody in the operating room and everywhere could hear just before we removed her, you know, took her out of the operating room to recovery room, so that everybody in all those places would hear me. I said, now you remember, after this surgery, as I've told you, no sex for 6 weeks. Well, she was so embarrassed by her son-in-law. She went to the recovery room, put her clothes on, and went home. And you know, you talk about pain. No, she took, well, one, the nurse gave her a codeine pill in the recovery room, which is typical. She never took another pill for any pain after that. But I knew this would take care of her recovery from surgery. And I have to say, you know, we became real good friends, my mother-in-law and I, because we both had lots of fun and taught each other a lot.
Yeah, that's great. But how do you deal, you know, first of all, as a surgeon, basically you have an understanding of what levels of pain people are going to experience, don't you?
Yeah, but it's also the mind.
I agree.
It's the surgeon's comment, well, any authority figure, okay, it could be your parents talking to a child, you know, your family members, the surgeon, the nurse, their words are hypnotic. So that's why I said, if you hear, oh, I'm going to have a bee sting versus here's a mosquito bite, you are programmed differently by your hypnotherapist.
Yeah.
So I have operated on people who have been hypnotized by me and hypnotherapists that I used to invite in the operating room. And, I mean, to pick up a knife and cut into somebody, and they don't feel a damn thing.
Right, right. It's possible.
You know, and I say, it's always my experience that would wake me up. It's amazing. Let me just say this to all our listeners, that when you get involved in something that, you know, really takes over your mind, it could be the creating, working in the garden, I don't care what it is, you know, it's something that really interests you and fascinates you, you realize you're not aware of your body. So you may have aches and pains and realize, wow, I didn't feel anything for 2 hours while I was, you know, having this wonderful time. And that's when you begin to realize how your consciousness plays such a powerful role in how your body feels.
Well, Bernie, let me support that idea for you, because in a discussion you and I had, I think it was the day before my surgery, you told me, give yourself the auto-suggestion to imagine, visualize, and imagine that all of the pain, not pain, all of the blood is moving away from the area of the prostate. It is completely leaving that area so that, number one, the surgeon can see better, work better, more accurately, and also that there wouldn't be a blood transfusion needed. Now, I told my surgeon I'm going to do that, expecting, you know, wondering what he's going to think. But the next day he said to me, your you know, theory worked. You absolutely did move that blood away, and it wasn't in my way.
Yeah.
That's good to you.
Studies have to say that some of these things I don't make up. I mean, they come from medical journals where studies were done on people who were having back surgery. And some were told to move the blood away from the air, you know, the spine that they were going to operate on. And they had less blood loss than the control group who weren't told to do anything.
Yeah.
And well, let me give you other examples. I mean, you know, people used to think I was nuts, but we're operating on somebody who has a heart arrhythmia. And I said out loud, I mean, this is somebody who's under anesthesia. I said, you're on a swing, up and back, a steady rhythm. And his heart went back to normal again.
Wow, wow.
And, you know, those are the things that fascinated everybody in the operating room. Wow, look what happened.
It's amazing.
But it opened their minds to all these possibilities. And I say nobody's against success. So things that were thought to be crazy, hey, if they work, who cares
why not?
They work? You know,
sure.
Don't worry about that. It helps. Do it. And so those things got taken over.
Powerful.
Yeah. You know, I often mention the music I played in the operating room, which helped everybody. And, yep. Well, let me, another hypnotic effect. When, as I said, we did children's surgery, I would play music that kids would hear, you know, nursery rhymes, all kinds of things. And I noticed that everybody in the operating room became childlike. It again, was having an impact on them and their memories and everything else. So everybody was happy and cheerful while you're playing children's
music. That's great.
And then with adults, I had a couple of really funny ones because I would bring in, you know, various tapes and discs and play them, and I didn't always know what every song was. But I was operating on a man, and I heard his voice say, "Is everything all right down there?" I said, "What are you worrying about? What's the matter?" "Listen to the music." Amazing Grace was playing. And then another guy said, "Are you listening to what you're playing?" I said, "What is it?" "It's Frank Sinatra singing All of Me. Why not take all of me?" And you know, but it's those happy moments, like you were talking about, that with the happiness, that just take away the pain, the fear, and everything else.
Well, you know, I think when you're grateful, for example.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful that that basically my surgeon has said to me, "It looks like you're cancer-free." I mean, they'll check and everything else. They'll find out in a couple of days for sure, but that's great news. Now, you can dwell on the fact that you had to have surgery, or you can put your mind over to the gratitude of all the things you have to be grateful for.
Yeah, I mean, see, you can hypnotize yourself. You can spend the rest of your life worrying now.
Sure.
What if it comes back? What if it isn't?
Right.
But
right.
That makes it more likely. What that
I agree.
The immune system.
I agree.
Versus when you see it healing and back to normal and feeling well again.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all vulnerable.
Yes.
That I've learned, you know.
I've had problems too.
Yeah. And I realize, hey, you're human. These things can happen.
Right.
But I've also learned from survivors.
Mm.
You know, I did a lot of reading of concentration camp literature years ago. To study people who survive and teach that to patients.
Well, Bernie, you mentioned Jack Schwartz to me.
Yeah, Jack Schwartz.
Concentration camp survivor and what he taught people.
Yeah, he was on a line, and, you know, the Germans are picking out who's going to the gas chamber, who's going to the work camp. And when he came up to the guard, he said, "Ich liebe dich." I love you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a hell of a lot harder to send that guy to the gas chamber than to the work camp.
Yeah.
And another gentleman, who wrote, what's his name, The Will to Live?
Rollo May? No.
No. It'll come to me. But he was in a concentration camp, too. And there was another inmate with him who was quite sick. And they announced, "We have a train coming that will take certain people to a work camp." And he said to his friend, "You go ahead and get on, because it'll be a better, you know, place, a better condition." And, of course, as it turned out, it was a train taking people to the gas chamber.
Yeah.
But here, out of his desire to help someone else, he ended up saving his life.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Doctors have written about how they were amazed when they and their community were thrown into concentration camps, how the people who had a will to live survived. No, see, they knew that if they couldn't work,
they
literally
die.
Had a bullet through the head, or they weren't fed, so they would just starve to death. And he said he couldn't believe watching people with heart disease, diabetes, you know, all kinds of problems, who wanted to survive. And he said that's where he saw the power of the mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, talking about that, I mentioned Jack Schwartz now. Maybe you could share with the audience.
Oh, yeah.
You,
well, the thing I mentioned about
the blood,
him, the
about
one
stopping
study,
the blood.
He told people he could control his bleeding, and they thought, that's a little nuts. But he said, "All right, let me show you. Stick a needle in my arm." And they stuck these big needles in his arm, and they pulled them out, and there was no blood. And they said to him, "Wow, you can do it." He said, "That doesn't prove anything. Do it again, and I will bleed. And then you know it was up to me."
Amazing.
And they did it again, and he bled. And that's the part, when I read these things, I learn, you know, the power we have. But you have to have a quiet mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's like not worrying, is it going to work? How is my surgery? What's going to happen to me?
Mm-hmm.
You've got to have that, what I call the still pond, the quiet mind.
Yep.
then you see the truth. Well, we got to take a break now. And when we come back, I got some other things I want to tell you.
Beautiful.
All right.
I'll be here.
Okay. Everybody come back because you'll enjoy the next.
Positive enlightenment. All you need in one place, here at HRNradio.com.
Hello, everybody. And, well, one thing that happened this morning, then I'll get to my story, that I was walking my little dog, Rags, and everybody look on the Internet and read that poem, Rags. You'll know why he has his name. But I was walking past the high school, and girls came out of the cafeteria saying, "Oh, what a cute dog, oh, what a cute dog." I said, "And he's got a handsome owner, too." Anyway, but I said to the girls, you know, when you're ready to get married, get a dog first.
Yeah.
Because one study showed that 35% of the women said they met the man they married walking the dog. But it's so interesting how people interact with you. You're walking a dog.
Yep.
You know, and oh, how cute the dog is. And but it's wonderful to interact with people. And you know, I told them to look up the poem also. I gave them homework because they were high school students. But now, let me get back to a little bit of even thinking of school. I grew up in Brooklyn, 1453 East 3rd Street between Avenue M and N. And the street was like family. It didn't matter, really, what race, religion, sex. I mean, everybody was family. What houses you went in and out of, where your friends were. Even the store owners. I mean, you could go in, buy something, and not pay them. And they would tell your parents, you know, that you bought something. My sister started coming home with lots of change. And we didn't understand what the hell was going on. And finally one day, my folks said to her, "Where are you getting all this?" She said, "This money, it's lying on the newspapers at the, you know, candy store." And then they realized people were buying a paper, dropping the money, and walking on.
Right.
And my sister thought it was just loose change lying there.
There you go.
Yeah. But again, the owner of the candy store, he didn't say, "Oh, you got to pay me." He laughed as much. You know, now he knew what was happening. But it was just that kind. But I wanted to say that across the street from me was my friend Carmine Berzamato. And Carmine was Catholic. My grandparents were Orthodox Jews. So our homes were different in the sense of our religion.
Right.
But we were buddies. We were like brothers. And I have to say that I would stay home on a lot of Catholic holidays from school, and he would stay home with me on Jewish holidays.
Really?
Even though our parents didn't know what we were doing.
Really?
We'd go out of the house and go to the other person's house. Yeah. But it was our way, you know, of enjoying each other. But in the living room was a picture of this guy, and I finally said one day, "Who is that hanging over your fireplace?" They said, "It's Jesus." Now, I didn't know who Jesus was, but I learned about him from them. And then one morning, I went over to pick up Carmine, you know, to walk to school together, BS 226. And he was still having breakfast, and his mother said, "Sit down, you can have some breakfast, too." "Okay." And I said, "Hey, this is good. What is it called?" "It's bacon." So that evening when I got home, I said to my grandfather, "Hey, I just had something good at Carmine's house called bacon." And I thought my grandfather was going to faint, you know, because they're strictly kosher and their grandson's eating bacon.
Right.
Will he go to heaven, you know?
Right, right.
But the nice part was my grandfather didn't walk across the street and say, "What are you feeding my grandson?" You know, everybody kind of laughed, and because we were family, you know, and we did
nice
crazy things. Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
well, you lived in a hell of a nice neighborhood. Wow.
It was. Yeah. I mean,
there wasn't
fear. You know,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
We had gangs, but the gangs were more like teams, if you know what I mean.
Right.
We competed with each other in the street, you know, playing games and balls.
Right.
Yeah, it wasn't about fighting or hurting, you know, anybody or taking power.
Mm-hmm.
It was just our street, and everybody had their street. So.
And you found a million and one games to play outside on in the street, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They had parks, you know, not too far away. But most of the time you played in the street. The sewer was like home plate and second base, you know, the next to it.
Yeah, the Spalding, Spalding was
first
the...
First and third were on the, you know, the curb, and we would play. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And you sat outside, so people were together. You know, every house wasn't air-conditioned, you know, so at night you sat out there and, I remember, all these stories pop into my head. I left the country. I had to go down to one of the Virgin Islands, and I didn't realize I needed a passport. And so it was really nice. We got all kinds of phone calls going to whoever was governing the island because I was going down there to do a workshop and a lecture. If I didn't get on the plane, I'm never going to be there in time.
Right.
And he was able to give permission to put me on the plane.
Beautiful.
But then when I came back, you know, you get off the plane. All right, let me see your passport. I don't have a passport. He said, where are you from? I said, I'm from Brooklyn. And the guard said, what's a stoop?
Oh, that's funny.
I said, it's what you sit on in front of the house.
Yeah.
He said, all right, go ahead. But I
that is funny.
I said, what? That? He said, look, I have a question for every city, every country. You know, like how many railroads are there in Puerto Rico? The answer is there aren't any. But, you know what I mean? But if you weren't a resident, you wouldn't know those things.
Yes, right.
And so I had a fun conversation with him about various questions. But then I moved on, let him get back to work.
Yeah, you know, much of the world doesn't really know what we're talking about, but having been raised in uptown Manhattan, that was my life as well. I mean, it was an amazing life. It was a lot of fun, and you were in the street, you met your friends, and had plenty of entertainment with the simplest things.
Yeah. And, you know, it gets back to how are you doing? And I think when you appreciate life, you're doing all right. But, you know, the thing, let me say this, because what I'm feeling now, my wife has had a lot of health problems the last 3 or 4 months due to a heart attack. And I know how tired I am, because she's lost a lot of strength and needs more help. So.
Right.
And, yes, and I've gotten help in. The kids will always say to me, Dad, don't try to do everything. But I notice getting tired is what is one of the hardest things for me to deal with. And I think it's partly my personality, you know. As a kid, I was always doing things.
Mm-hmm.
That interested me. But I'd like to, when we come back for the next break, to talk to you about that. When you're tired, because you talk about a happiness club, but what if you're tired and you can't do the things that would make you happy? What do you do then? So think about that.
That's a good question.
All right.
I will think about that.
Okay, and then we'll talk about it when we come back.
Because I have been tired.
All positive natural health programs on HRNradio.com.
Welcome back, everyone. We should get Schwarzenegger on.
Yeah, well, you did a pretty good imitation. that was good.
let's see. Oh, yeah, we talked about when you're tired. Because in my life, I've always doing things. And I'm not talking about being physically tired.
Oh.
Then you take a rest. But I'm talking about mentally, when there's too many damn things happening. I always remember Joseph, Campbell saying, you engage and disengage.
Mm.
And I was thinking about that this morning. I was taking my meditation walk. You need to disengage. Say no to more things.
Yeah.
Many years ago, when I say many, talking maybe 50 years ago, I sought out Elizabeth Kubler-Ross to help me and be my therapist. And I remember her saying to me, Borni, that's a Swiss accent, Borni, you have needs too.
Right.
That sentence is like a wallop. You know, that you have to say no at times.
Yeah.
And
you're right.
You know, and say yes to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You have needs too.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to think taking a nap was, what a waste of time.
Yeah.
You know, because my wife was good at it. You know, let's take a rest. But, I mean, today I know damn well it's not a waste of time. It's a way to restore yourself.
Right.
And
it's loving yourself.
Yeah. You got to pay attention to yourself and your body.
Mm-hmm.
But to not, and I think a lot of it has to do with how you grow up, that if you feel guilt over taking care of yourself, you know, you're being selfish.
Right.
That's nuts. taking care of yourself isn't being selfish.
Exactly.
It's doing the right thing and then being able to help others.
Well, yeah. I mean, the airlines are a perfect example of that. If you need oxygen and the oxygen mask falls down, your instructions are to put it on your face first before you help anybody else.
Right.
Because if you're passed out, what good are you?
Yeah. Take care of your
needs. Well, you know, I've been experiencing physical tiredness as well as, I guess, mental, but maybe not so much mental. But for me, it is doing what I can to eliminate any... In other words, let me put it this way. The first most important rule, I think, in life is to know what is in your control and what is not in your control. And I think a lot of times we're trying to control things that are completely out of our control. So that's a little foolish. So if you realize that that's your first, criteria to figure out, okay, what can I control, what can't I, then you actually have, the power to make a choice. But otherwise, you don't really have you're not making a choice. You're just expending energy in a direction that's worthless.
Well, I always say to people, there's only one thing you do control. It's your own thoughts.
Absolutely.
What's going on in your head.
Absolutely. Well, as you were speaking, I realize now why I did some of the things I did this week. You know, I was feeling tired, and I said, well, I don't really want to go out and run around, even though I would love to do things for other people. So I have a meeting tomorrow. It's a luncheon, and we usually spend 3 hours together, a whole bunch of us, monthly. It's going on for almost 2 years. So that'll go on, but I won't be there. And then Thursday at 1:30, we have an hour meeting at Bridge House, which I've been running for 12 years. And I won't be there either, and they know it, and they know I love them, so it's fine. But I had to put myself first. And, yes, I'd like to be there because I do enjoy those things, but when you feel you're not up to it, I think you have to be rational enough, and you have to really love yourself enough to take care of yourself, because then you're no good to anyone.
Yeah.
And you taught me a lot of that because, you know, as you've always said, you take a nurse and you say, your family's driving you crazy and they ask you to do something you really don't want to do. What do you say? And they always say, yeah, I'll do it.
Yeah. They're saving everybody.
Yeah.
And you have to learn to save yourself.
First.
Okay. Yeah, because otherwise you can't help anybody else.
Exactly. Exactly.
As I say, and it's all in your head what you do. And the trouble, again, is what's imposed upon you by others when you're growing up as a child. You know, I mean, if your parents said, oh, you have to do what everybody else asks of you, don't be selfish, then you see it as something selfish. But if they said, like my mother would say, do what makes you happy.
Well, you had a smart mother. Most of us didn't have that.
Because they all grew up with plenty of troubles.
Sure.
You know?
Right.
Really coming to this country to save their lives.
Yep.
So they had, come out of hell, and it was a blessing to be here. But they had learned about survival, and
absolutely,
were living those messages and teaching them to their kids. Because I have people who say to me, "You didn't ask me what mottos I'm dying by."
Right.
And those are things their parents would repeat to them.
It's true.
Which was killing them.
Yeah, it's true.
It doesn't make any damn sense.
Yeah, those thoughts running around our heads are very important. They have tremendous impact on our lives.
Yeah, I've had, dealt with a lot of people who wanted to commit suicide. I mean, and some of them would come to me to help them. And I have to say, I have learned to help people die and to help them live, but not help them kill themselves.
Right.
Because if some of them, due to illnesses or problems, said, I'm tired, I want to go, okay. I don't think you have to help people, with assisted suicide. If you want to go, I just call it turning off the light switch. You let your body know, I'm done.
Yep.
I'm ready. And then you don't have trouble leaving. It may sound crazy to some listeners, but it changes again your body chemistry. And it gives your body a message that I'm tired of life. Mm-hmm. I always say that's like the Monday morning syndrome. If you hate your life on Monday due to your job, your traffic, your whatever, your body does you a favor. From heart attacks to strokes to suicides to illnesses.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that people have to understand, just the science behind this, a graduate student, University of South Florida, took two actors, gave them a comedy and a tragedy. The tragedy was man murdered the woman's husband. Now, in the comedy, all their immune functions went up, the stress hormone levels went down. In the tragedy, all the immune function went down and the stress hormone levels went up.
Right.
Now, what impressed me when his professor, was telling me about it, was that it was only acting. And I began to notice that on Broadway. You're in Mel Brooks' production, you go on for years.
Yeah.
And you don't drop out. But when you're in Death of a Salesman,
right,
you don't make it through the winter. And I mean it. This literally happened a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, again, what is it like to be there? How vulnerable are you to an illness? And so you drop out. But people, again, need to realize if you're in control of what you're thinking,
mm-hmm.
then stop and laugh. You don't need a reason.
Well, see what you're saying.
Yeah,
what you're saying is acting as if, even though you think you're pretending, it becomes just as real as anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. And good therapists understand that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what's his name? I love him, William Saroyan, the author. He said, "Everybody alive is an actor, but almost everybody alive is a very pathetic actor." And that's why we're given a lifetime to rehearse and practice.
Yeah.
And so, think about who you are, your identity, not what others impose on you. Because that gets back to the spiritual age-old message that if you need to save your life, or think you do, by doing what everybody else wants of you, then you lose your life.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But when you're willing to reclaim your true self, then, you come to life again.
Right. Right, yeah. That's true.
So
that
you
very
lose
true.
The untrue self and give birth to the true self. And then a whole new thing. All right.
All right.
And
we'll have a lot
to
more
talk
to share.
About the number eight.
The number eight,
we
okay.
We have 8 minute breaks, and that means something too. Talk about numbers. All right.
All right.
Your source for timeless natural health talk, HRNradio.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. One of the things that I had mentioned was about
the number eight.
Yeah.
The number eight.
Another thing you were talking about, how you're tired after surgery. You have to understand also that the hormones that relate to healing and immune function make you feel tired. It's like your body wants you to be tired and take a rest certain times.
Okay.
It's part of the recovery process.
Mm-hmm.
So that part's normal. The number eight, yeah.
Yeah.
Years ago, I did a lot of reading of Jung. I loved the man and all he knew. But he said, numbers are discovered and invented of quantity and meaning. And one of the things that's interesting is every religion has how many days in the week?
Seven.
Yeah. How about how many days in the month?
Well, that varies, but...
That's right. So, did you ever stop and think, why does one vary and not the other? Seven, well, how many days did it take God to create?
Seven. Well,
seven.
Six.
It's like a cycle.
7 days rested, yeah.
Yeah. But it's that cycle of 7 days. And so, eight is a new beginning.
I see.
So, when that number pops up in people's drawings, dreams... It speaks of a new beginning, something new coming into their life. And, there's so many simple things I tend to think about. Why are there 60 seconds in a minute and 60 minutes in an hour? Who picks 60?
Mm.
Why didn't they pick 100? But one of the things I thought about is I'm sitting in one of the rooms in our house with the clock ticking. I thought, wow, if it was 100, it'd be going... Tick, 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 tick. And
right.
I'd be getting nervous. But listening to tick, tick, tick.
Yeah.
And so in music, you get that sense when it's that slow rhythm. and things I played in the operating room that relaxed people,
right,
versus noisy, jazzy music that didn't distract you and got you hyper.
Mm-hmm.
So people have to realize, and when you see it in dreams and drawings, I mean, there are times people make 57 bricks out of path, and then they go, oh, my God, I was born in 1957.
Wow.
And, you know, that young lady had some genital defects problems, so it was a tough time. But it immediately pops up to the person. You know what I mean? It's not me saying this is what it could mean.
Mm-hmm.
It's, why did you do that? Say, yeah, well, when I drew my first picture, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, one of her questions was, why is 11 important? I said, well, what are you asking me that for? You put 11 trees in the drawing. And it was 11 months, I said. I've been doing this for 11 months. I mean, that immediately was my answer. You know what I mean? It wasn't searching for something.
Yeah, right.
It, like, popped out of my unconscious. And I'd say to people, yeah, you want to learn about yourself, pay attention to your dreams, do some drawings, you know, just from your mind, just draw an outdoor scene, and look at the things that are in it. Past,
amazing,
present, and future, all the things that we're creating. And numbers are an amazing resource. I always look for them. Even what time it is when I go to bed, is that my birthday on the clock, you know, things like that. I don't mean I'm...
So let me ask you a question. If you wake up in the middle of the night and you look at the clock, is there any meaning in that?
Well, sometimes I think if it's a certain number, it's a good sign, you know? Like, I was born on the 14th, my wife on the 9th. So 23 to me is a special number.
Okay.
You know, put the two things together. And so, yeah, if I woke up or found something, you know, and it was 23, I'd say, oh, this is a good sign.
I see.
I'd feel good about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could say, you know, that's you. Yeah, but it still makes me feel good to have that number present. Yeah, even when I play the lottery, I play, like, we have five kids with twins, so we have six birthdays, and I play them.
Okay.
You know, and once, I have to say, four out of six were right.
Oh, there you go.
I only won $35.
Oh, wow.
Which seemed to me to be underpaying. But
right, you were underpaying.
Yeah. but it's fun, you know, to do something like that.
Sure.
Then it's not just guessing. It's having fun with the numbers in your life.
Yeah. You know, Bernie, talking about being tired mentally, I think an important aspect of that is, you know, again, the mental is everything. You know, it's the real world we connect with, but basically the real connection is within. And if we take a moment to find some kind of peace, whether it's a moment of meditation or a quiet reflection or just quieting down, closing your eyes, whatever works for people, then I think we have a different grasp on stillness and peace, because ultimately, this is really all about peace. We don't seem to... Peace is what we all need, what we all want, but we don't seem to attain it.
God, you just made me... Two things I got to tell you. I had a patient in the hospital, very agitated, having all kinds of trouble. Said that, you may have peace, you may choose peace, or you may choose conflict.
Uh-huh.
What do you think he said?
Could you say peace or comfort?
Conflict.
Oh, conflict. I can't believe he would choose conflict, but maybe
no,
he did.
No, he didn't. He said, I'll have pizza. That really happened. You may choose peace or you may choose conflict. I'll have pizza.
I think that was a good choice.
I know. And then we burst out laughing. And it's like, what are you laughing at? You know,
yeah.
And then the two of us, the conflict was gone. You know what I mean?
Right.
He laughed. Everything was over.
Exactly.
I'll never forget that. I mean, I'm trying to help him.
Well, laughter is another answer for what we're talking
that's
about.
Right.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, you can't be in trouble when you laugh. The other, our cat Princess, is always walking across, you know, the desk in front of me and on the computer and everything. And she just came up. And that's another thing. You pet a furry creature.
Yep.
Your bonding hormones rise. And you feel good about everybody. That's like when I walked past the high school today with our dog. I mean, the girls came out of the cafeteria to tell me I have a cute dog. And
wow.
met him, and we had a therapy session, you know.
Yep, yep.
I told him a poem I want them to read, things I want them to do, and blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
But, it, you know, you're connected again. And I have to say, this, what you learn, because this cat, Miracle, I mean, Princess, walked across the keyboard one morning and screwed up the whole computer. And I didn't know what she did. I didn't know how to fix it. Well, a few minutes later, you know, I'm sitting there totally frustrated. She walked back over the keys, and it started working.
Oh, that's funny.
Now, you tell me how the hell that happened.
That's pretty amazing. Yeah, that's pretty
but
amazing.
It was, what a remarkable event. Yeah.
Wow.
So
unexplained.
Yeah, but that's the way she is. I mean, there are other cats who jump up here and very carefully avoid the keyboard. You know, it's like they know you shouldn't step up.
Right.
But anyway, yeah, I was going to talk about that cat.
Well, you got time. You got a minute.
The miracle that I popped out of me, because that was a cat who was named after a cat in a dream, who said to the lady, "My name is Miracle. This is how you should treat your cancer."
Wow.
And what I loved was her doctor said, "Okay, I'll do it."
Wow.
I mean, I thought most doctors would say, "Lady, you crazy? You want me to treat you based on a cat in a dream?" But, of course, she got well. And thank God he had an open mind and did it. But that's the part, you know, when I say, when you get your consciousness to be quiet, then the truth comes out.
Well, there it
in
is.
In the dreams, yeah. In the drawings, in numbers, yeah. Whatever it is, all kinds of symbols, it happens.
Well, Bernie, you know, for years now, decades, you've been helping so many people around the world. And I personally thank you for helping me because, you know, you gave me specific things to do, and I did them. I didn't believe or not believe in them. I just followed them, and they worked, and they benefited me. So thank you for all that you've brought forth for all of us, because this is a big change and a welcome one.
Well, when you're a coach or a teacher, if people show up to class and to practice, things happen.
Absolutely.
Find everybody. Show up. Find the right life coaches. Things happen.